normally. Other sources have suggested everything from an elaborate Halloween hoax to the detonation of some kind of electromagnetic pulse device, which has disrupted the city's electrical utilities. A press conference has reportedly been scheduled for later this evening. We'll be on the air all through the current crisis, giving you up-to-date information as quickly as we... The announcer's voice broke up into wild static and sound. Thomas reached over and flicked the radio off. "Had it on for 20 minutes," he said. "Got a clear signal for maybe 5 of them." I grunted. "Do you know what's happened?"
"Maybe," I said. "Where's Butters?"
Thomas tilted his head toward the back door. "Walking mouse." I took a seat at the little kitchen table, getting my weight off of my injured leg.
"Today's going to be pretty intense," I said.
Thomas flipped a pancake.
"Because of the heirs of Kemmler?"
"Yeah," I said. "If Mab is right about what they're trying to do, someone has to stop them before tonight."
"Why?"
"Because after that, I'm not sure anyone will be able to stop them," I said.
My brother nodded.
"Think you can take them?"
"They're fighting among themselves," I said. "They're all going to be more worried about their fellow necromancers than they are about me."
"Uh-huh," Thomas said. "But do you think you can take them?"
"No."
"Then what you're talking about isn't heroism, man. It's suicide."
I shook my head.
"I don't need to kill them. I only need to stop them. If I play this right, I won't need to fight anybody."
Thomas flipped another pancake. The cooked side was a uniform shade of perfect light brown.
"How are you going to manage that?"
"They need 2 things to make this godhood thing go," I said. "The Earl King and the knowledge in the word of Kemmler. If I can deny them either, the whole shebang is canceled."
"You figure out those numbers yet?" Thomas asked.
"No."
"So what?
You're going to put a hit on the Earl King to keep him from showing up?"
I shook my head.
"Mab gave me the impression that the Earl King was in the same weight class as her."
"She tough?" Thomas asked.
"Beyond the pale," I said.
"So you can't kill the Earl King. What then?"
"I summon him myself."
He arched an eyebrow.
"Look, no matter how mighty he is, he can't be in 2 places at once. If I call him up and keep him busy, then the heirs can't summon him to their ceremony."
He nodded.
"How are you going to call him?"
"The book," I said. "It's almost got to be one of those poems or songs. One of them must be an incantation to attract the Earl King's attention."
"But you don't have the book," Thomas said.
"Yeah," I said. "That's the kink I haven't worked out yet."
Thomas nodded, scraping the last of the batter out of a bowl and onto the griddle.
"Even if you do figure out how to call the Earl King, it sounds like he might be kind of dangerous."
"Probably, but impersonal. That means not as dangerous as one of the heirs going godly and showing up to give me some payback for annoying them," I shrugged. "And the only one in danger will be me."
"Wrong," Thomas said. "I'll be with you."
I had been sure he would say something like that, but hearing it still felt pretty good.
Thomas had a truckload of baggage, and he wasn't always the most pleasant person in the world, but he was my brother. Family. He'd stand with me.
Which made what came next hard to say.
"You can't," I said. His expression smoothed over into neutrality.
"Because of Mavra?"
"No," I said. "Because I'm going to bring in the White Council."
Thomas dropped his spatula onto the kitchen floor.
"I have to," I said. "It took all the wardens together to take down Kemmler and his students last time. I might not be able to prevent the Earl King's arrival. If that happens, someone has to stop the heirs directly. I can't do it. The wardens can. It's as simple as that."
"Okay," he said. "But that doesn't explain why I can't stick with you."
"Because to them you're just a White Court vampire, Thomas, with whom I am supposed to be at war. If they learn that you're my brother, it might give the people in the council, who don't like me, grounds to question my loyalty. And even if they believe that I'm not acting against the council or being controlled by you, they'd still be suspicious of you. They'd want assurances that you were on their team."
"They'd use me," he said quietly, "and use me against you."
"They'd use us both against each other, which is why you can't be around when they show."
Thomas turned and studied my face carefully.
"What about Murphy?" If you call in the council, Mavra will screw up her life.
I chewed on my lip a little. Murphy wouldn't want me to put innocence in danger to protect her. If one of the heirs turns into some kind of dark god, people are going to die. She wouldn't forgive me for protecting her if that was the cost, I said. Besides, this isn't about recovering the word. This is about stopping the heirs. I can still get the book to Mavra and fulfill our bargain.
Thomas took a deep breath. Is that wise?
I don't know. She's not exactly alive. I doubt Kemmler's techniques would apply to her use of magic.
If they didn't, Thomas said, then why would she want the book?
Which was a damned good question.
I rubbed at my eyes. All I know is that I've got to stop the heirs, and I've got to protect Murphy.
If the council finds out that you're planning on using them to defeat the heirs so that you can give Kemmler's book to a vampire of a black court, you'll be in trouble.
Not for long, I said. The wardens will execute me on the spot.
God, and you can accept that from your own people?
I'm acclimated, I said.
We were quiet for a moment.
You want me to sit this out, Thomas said. You don't want me to help.
I don't see that I have much choice, I told him. Do you?
You could just leave this whole thing. We could head for Aruba or something.
I looked at him.
Okay, he said. You won't, but a guy can hope.
I just don't like the idea of sitting on the sidelines when you might need my help.
He frowned.
Hey, you're doing this on purpose. You're trying to keep me out of it to protect me, you sneaky little bitch.
It works out that way, I said. Think of it as payback for those painkillers.
He grimaced at me, then nodded.
And thank you, I said quietly. You were right. I needed the rest.
Of course I was right, Thomas said. You looked like you were about to pass out. You still don't look great.
I'm hungry. Did you make those pancakes for breakfast, or are they only decorative?
Go ahead and mock, Thomas said.
He slapped a bunch of pancakes onto a plate and brought it over to the table, along with a plastic bottle of maple syrup.
Here, happy birthday.
I blinked at the pancakes and then up at him.
I'd have gotten you a present, but... He shrugged.
No, I said. I mean, no, that's okay. I'm surprised you remembered it all. No one has remembered my birthday since Susan left town.
Thomas got himself a plate and left the rest on a third plate for Butters. He sat down at the table and started eating them without syrup.
Don't make a big thing of it. I'm sort of surprised I remembered it myself.
He nodded at the world in general.
So you think Gravain and the Corpse Taker are the ones who turned the lights out?
I shook my head.
They were both stretching themselves by keeping so many undead under their control. That's why the Corpse Taker went after Gravain with a sword, and why he defended himself physically.
Then who did it?
Cowl, I said. He made himself scarce last night. My guess is that he was too busy setting it up to take a swing at Gravain or the Corpse Taker.
Why Cowl?
Because this is a major hex, man. If you'd have asked me yesterday, I wouldn't have thought this was possible. I don't know how he did it, but... I shivered. His magic is stronger than mine. And from what I saw of his technique, he's a hell of a lot more skilled, too. If he's as good at thaumaturgy as he is at evocation, he's the most dangerous wizard I've ever seen.
I'm not sure how he did it matters as much as why, Thomas said.
I nodded. He gets a lot of advantages. Paralyzes human power structures. Keeps cops and so on too busy to interfere with whatever they're doing.
But that's not the only reason. You said something about preparing the way?
Yeah. I finished a large bite of syrupy pancake goodness. Black magic is tied in pretty closely with a lot of negative emotions, especially fear. So if you do something that scares a whole lot of people, you get an environment that is better for black magic. This stunt is going to cause havoc, make a lot of people worry. It will help with the heir's major mojo tonight.
You're sure it's tonight?
I nodded.
Pretty much. It's Halloween. The barriers between the mortal world and the spirit world are at their weakest. They'll be able to call up the most spirits to devour tonight. All the acts of black magic they've been working around town were also part of that preparation, creating spiritual turbulence, making it easier to use larger and larger amounts of black magic. Thomas ate several bites while he listened. Then he said, "How are you going to contact the council with the phones out?"
"Alternative channels," I said. "I'll call up a messenger."
"Meanwhile," Thomas said, his voice a little bitter, "I will stay here and do nothing."
"No, you won't," I said, "because you're going to be figuring out where they'll call up the most old spirits. Not only that, but I'm leaving you a copy of Bony Tony's code numbers. Figure out what they mean."
He toyed with a bit of pancake.
"Old spirits would come from a graveyard, right?"
"Probably," I said. "But sometimes they can get attached to possessions instead of a specific location. See what you can find out about Native American burial grounds or ruins. That's the right age bracket for what the heirs want."
"Okay," Thomas said, without much confidence. "And you want me to figure out the numbers, too?"
"With Butters," I said. "He can help you on both counts. He's damn smart."
"Assuming he wants to help," Thomas said. "He might want to cash in his chips and get out of this game while he's still alive."
"If he does, then you'll be on your own," I said. "But I don't think he will." Just then, the kitchen door opened and Butters came in with a panting mouse. The big dog padded over to me and nudged my hand with his nose until I scratched him in his favorite spot, just behind one notched ear.
"Don't think who will what?" Butters asked. "Oh, hey, pancakes. Are there any for me?"
"Counter," Thomas said.
"Cool."
"Butters," I said, "look, I think you're going to be all right on your own now. If you want me to, I'll take you home after breakfast."
He peered owlishly at me and said,
"Of course I want to go home. The Oktoberfest polka off is tonight."
Thomas arched an eyebrow at me. Butters looked back and forth between us and said,
"Do you need me to do something?"
"Maybe," I said. "There's some research to be done. I totally understand if you want to get while the getting's good. But if you're willing, we could use your help."
"Research," Butters said. "What kind of research?"
I told him. Butters chewed on his lip.
Is anything going to try to kill me for doing it?"
"I don't think so," I said, "but I can't lie to you. These are some dangerous people. I can't predict everything they might do." Butters nodded.
"But if you don't get this information, what happens?"
"It gets harder to stop them."
"And if you don't stop them, what happens?"
I put my fork down, suddenly not very hungry. "One of them gets phenomenal cosmic power and all the living space he can take. I get killed, so will a lot of innocent people, and God only knows what someone could do with power like that over the long term." Butters looked down at his pancakes. I waited. Thomas said nothing. His appetite hadn't been affected, and the sound of his knife and fork on the plate was the only one in the kitchen.
"This is bigger than me," he said finally. "It's bigger than polka, even. So I guess I'll help."
I smiled at him. "Appreciate it." Thomas looked up, studying Butters speculatively.
"Yeah?"
Butters nodded and grimaced.
"If I walk away when I know I could lend a hand, I'm not sure I could live with that. I mean, if you were asking me to shoot somebody or something, I'd head for the hills. But research is different. I can do research."
I rose and clapped Butters gently on the shoulder. "Thomas will fill you in."
"Where are you going?"
he asked. "I have to figure out how to call up the Earl King," I said.
"Is that why everyone wanted that book?"
"Apparently."
"But you had it. Heck, you read it."
I rubbed at my eyes. "Yeah, I know, but I didn't know exactly what I was looking for." Butters nodded.
"Frustrating, huh?"
"Just a bit."
"It's too bad you don't have a photographic memory," Butters said. "I knew a guy in college with one of those, the bastard. He could just look at a page and then read it back to himself in his head a week later."
A thought struck me hard, and I felt my limbs twitch with sudden excitement.
"What did you say?" You don't have a photographic memory?" Butters asked.
"Yes," I said. "Butters, you are a genius."
"I am," he said.
Then his brow furrowed in puzzlement.
"I am?"
"Brilliant," I said, "certifiably."
"Oh, good."
I rose and started gathering my things. "Where's that backpack I had you wear?"
Living room, Butters said. Why?
You might need it. I limped out to the living room and got the backpack. I touched it lightly and felt the solid curve of Bob the Skull within. I got my coat and my car keys and headed for the back door.
Where are you going? Thomas asked.
Gumshoeing, I said.
You shouldn't go alone.
Probably not, I agreed, but I am.
At least take Mouse, Thomas said.
The big dog tilted his head quizzically, looking back and forth between Thomas and me.
And hold his leash in my teeth, I said. I've only got the one hand to work with.
Thomas frowned and then rolled a shoulder in a shrug.
Okay.
The phones are apparently unreliable, I said. I tossed the backpack at Thomas. He caught it. Bob will know how to reach me if he finds something. Got that, Bob?
A muffled voice from the backpack said,
Jawohl, Herr Kommandant.
Butters jumped halfway out of his chair and made a squeaking sound.
What was that?
Explain it to him, I told Thomas. I'll be in touch as soon as I can. My brother nodded at me.
Good luck. Be careful.
You too. Keep your eyes open. Thanks again, Butters.
Sure, sure. See you soon.
Butters poked at the backpack with his fork.
Hey!
Bob protested from inside the pack.
Stop that! You'll scratch it all up!
I swung out the door. The night's rest had done me good, and realizing how it might be possible to stop the heirs of Kemmler had given me an electric sense of purpose. I strode to the car, barely feeling my aching leg. I turned my hand over and regarded Sheila's phone number written on it in black marker. I didn't have a photographic memory, but I knew someone who did. Chapter 27. I went to my office. Traffic wasn't as bad as it could have been. It looked like the commuters hadn't poured into town in the usual volume. The traffic lights were out, but there were cops at most of the problem intersections, and everyone seemed to be driving slowly and reasonably during the crisis. That's what they were calling it on the radio, the crisis. There were a lot more people than usual out and about on the street, and with far less of the usual brisk, business-like manner. All in all, it was about the best reaction to the situation you could hope for. It seemed like people could go one of two ways. Either they freak out and start rioting, or they actually act like human beings in trouble ought to and look out for one another. When L.A. blacked out, there had been big-time rioting. In New York, people had pulled together. It was just as well that people hadn't reacted quite so blindly as they might have. Without even trying, I could feel the slow, sour tension of black magic pulsing and swirling through the city. With the subtle influence of all that dark energy behind it, even a mild panic could have turned ugly, and fast. Of course, it wasn't dark yet. Nightfall could change things. As advanced as mankind likes to think it is, we all have that age-old, primal, undeniable dread of darkness. Of being unable to see danger coming. We don't like to think that we're afraid of the dark anymore, but if that's true, then why do we work so hard to make sure our cities are constantly lit? We cloak ourselves in so much light that we can barely see the stars at night. Fear is a funny thing. In the right light, even tiny and insignificant fears can suddenly grow, swelling up to monstrous proportions. With the black magic rolling around the way it was, that instinctive fear of the dark would feed upon itself, doubling and redoubling, and with no explanation to tell them why the lights hadn't come on, people would start to forget their carefully rational reasons not to be afraid in favor of panic. Even assuming I prevented a brand spanking new dark godling from arising, tonight could be bad. It could be very bad. I got to my office and tried to call Sheila's number. The phones weren't cooperating with me, which hardly came as a surprise. They rarely worked perfectly on the best of days. I kept a copy of a reverse phone book at my office, though, and I found the address of her Cabrini Green apartment. While it wasn't as bad as it had been in the past, it wasn't exactly the best part of town, either. I had a brief pang of longing for the gun I'd lost in the alley behind Bach's place. It wasn't that the gun was more effective than other things I could do to defend myself, but it was a hell of a lot more of a deterrent to the average Chicago thug than a carved stick. Just for fun, I tried the phones again, dialing my contact number for the nearest outpost of the wardens.
So help me God, the phone rang.
Yes, answered a woman with a low, roughened voice. I fumbled my little notebook of security phrases out of my duster's pocket.
One second, I said. I didn't think the call would go through.
I flipped the little notebook open to the last page and said,
Chartreuse Sirocco.
Rabbit, answered the voice. I checked the notebook. It was the countersign.
This is Wizard Dresden, I said. I have a code wolf situation here. Repeat, code wolf.
The woman on the other end of the phone hissed.
This is Warden Lucio, wizard.
Holy crap. The boss herself.
Anastasia Lucio was one of the next in line for a seat on the senior council and was the commander of the wardens. She was one tough old bird, and she was the field commander of the council's forces in the war with the Red Court.
Warden Lucio, I said respectfully, both because she probably deserved it and because I needed to get along with her as well as I possibly could.
What is the situation? She asked.
At least three apprentices to the necromancer Kemler are here in Chicago, I said. They found the fourth book. They're going to use it tonight.
There was a stunned silence from the other end of the phone.
Hello, I said.
Are you sure?
Lucio asked. Her voice had a faint Italian accent.
How do you know who they are?
All those zombies and ghosts were sort of a giveaway, I said. I confronted them. They identified themselves as Gravain, Cowl, and Capio Corpus, and they each had a drummer with them.
Dio,
Lucio said.
Do you know where they are?
Not yet, but I'm working on it, I said. Can you help?
Affirmative, Lucio said. We will dispatch wardens to Chicago immediately. They will arrive at your apartment within 6 hours.
Might not be the best place, I said. I was attacked there last night, and my wards got torn apart. The apartment may be under surveillance.
Understood. Then we will rendezvous at the alternate location.
I checked the notebook. I'd have to meet them at McAnally's.
Gotcha, I said.
Que cosa? She asked.
Understood, Warden, I said. 6 hours, alternate location. Don't skimp on the personnel either. These folks are serious.
I am familiar with Kemmler's disciples, she said, though her tone was more one of agreement than reprimand.
I will lead the team myself. 6 hours.
Right, 6 hours. She hung up the phone. I settled it back onto its cradle, lips pursed in thought. Hell's bells. The war captain of the White Council herself was to take the field. That meant that this situation was being regarded as an emergency tantamount to a terrorist with an armed nuclear bomb. If the head warden was coming out to battle, it meant that the wardens were going to pull out all the stops. I was going to have a lot of help for a change. Help that held me in deadly suspicion, and who might execute me if they learned some of my secrets, but help nonetheless. I felt an odd sense of comfort. The wardens had been one of my biggest fears, practically since I had learned about their existence. There was something deeply satisfying about seeing the object of that fear take a hostile interest in Gravain and company. Like when Darth Vader turns against the Emperor and throws him down the shaft. There's nothing quite so cool as seeing someone who scares the hell out of you go at an enemy. And then a disturbing thought occurred to me. Why in hell was the war captain of the White Council answering the freaking phones? Why wasn't a junior member of the wardens doing the receptionist work? I could think of only a couple or three reasons. None of them were pleasant. My brief flash of relief and confidence melted away. Good thing it did, too. I'm sure the world would come to an end if I were allowed to feel a sense of relief and well-being for any length of time. I shoved my worry out of my head. It wasn't going to help anything. The only one I could count on to ride to my rescue was me. If the wardens managed to do it anyway, it would be a nice surprise, but I had to get myself moving before the problem started looking too big. It was the same principle as cleaning a really messy room. You don't think about everything you have to do. You focus on one thing and get it done, then move on to the next. I needed the summons that was hidden in Der Urlking. To get that, I had to talk to Sheila.
Right, Harry.
get a move on. I tried the phone once more, but I guess I'd already won the functional tech lottery. All circuits were busy. I hadn't been sitting down very long, but it was long enough for my leg to make it clear to the rest of my body that it didn't want to be walked on anymore today. Get with the program, I told my legs severely. You don't have to be happy about it, but I need you functional. My leg sat there in sullen silence and throbbed, which I took as an assent. I reached for my keys and then heard a soft sound at my office door. I whirled my staff into my hand, calling up my will, and the runes were already smoldering with sullen orange light when the door opened. Billy stood in the doorway, his expression frozen in surprise, his mouth open. He was wearing jeans, cowboy boots, and an old leather jacket. He hadn't worn his glasses much over the past several years, but he had them on today. His hair had been mussed by the wind, which sighed against my office windows. I heard a few drops of rain begin to fall, striking with dull taps on the glass. He said after a minute. Hi, Harry. I scowled at him and lowered the staff, letting the power ease out of it. The warmed wood felt good under my hand, and the faint scent of wood smoke lay on the air. Bad time to be appearing suddenly in my office door, I said. Next time I'll whistle or something, Billy replied. How'd you find me? It's your office. He looked around the place. You talking to someone? Not really, I said. What do you need? He opened his coat. The handle of a gun protruded from his belt, my revolver. Artemis Bach came by my place. He said there was some trouble at his store. Yeah, I said. Bad guys were trying to rough him up. I argued with him about it. Billy nodded. That's what he said. He found this in the alley outside. He said there was blood. One of them clipped my leg, I said. I got it taken care of. Billy nodded, worried. He was worried about you. I'm fine, I stood up, careful about my leg. Bach okay? Billy said. He looked at me, his expression clearly concerned. Yeah. Not hurt, I mean. Some damage to the store, which he said he didn't mind. He wanted me to thank you for him. He pulled the gun out of his belt and said, And I thought you might need this. Shouldn't carry it in your pants like that, I said. Good way to sing soprano. It's empty, he said, and offered me the handle of the gun. I took it, flipped the cylinder open, and checked it. The gun wasn't loaded. I slid it into the pocket of my duster, then opened the drawer of my desk and took out a small box of ammunition I kept there. I put it in the pocket along with the gun. Thanks for bringing that by, I said. Why'd you come looking here? You didn't answer the phone at your place. I went by there. It looked like someone tried to tear the door off. Someone did, I said. But you're all right? There was a little more weight on the question than I would have expected. I'm fine, I said, getting impatient. Hell's bells, Billy. If you've got something to say, go ahead and say it. He inhaled deeply. Well, I'm sort of afraid to. I arched a brow at him and scowled again. Look, you aren't acting right, Harry. Meaning? I asked. Meaning not like yourself, Billy said. People have been noticing. People? I asked. My leg pounded. I had no time for this kind of psychological patty cake. What people? People who respect you, he said carefully. Maybe who are even a little bit afraid of you. I just stared at him. I don't know if you know this, Harry, but you can be a really scary guy. I mean, I've seen what you can do, and even the people who haven't seen themselves have heard stories. Believe me, we're all glad you're one of the good guys, but if you weren't... What? I said, suddenly feeling more tired. If I wasn't, then what? You'd be scary. Really scary. Get to your damn point, I said quietly. He nodded. You've been talking to things. Excuse me? He lifted his hands. Talking to things. I mean, you were talking to things when I was outside your door. That was nothing, I said. Okay, Billy said, though his tone suggested that he was placating me rather than agreeing. What's this talking to things crap? Did Bach say I was doing that? Harry, Billy said. Because I wasn't, I said. Good God. I do some crazy crap, but it's usually the this is never going to work, but I have to try it variety of crazy. I'm not insane. Billy folded his arms, his eyes searching my face. See, that's the thing. If you were truly insane, would you be able to realize it? I rubbed at the bridge of my nose. So let me get this straight. Because Bach said something about me, and because you heard me talking to myself, suddenly I'm ready for the room with rubber walls. No, he said. Sort of. Harry, look, it isn't like I'm trying to accuse. That's funny, because it sounds like an accusation from this end, I said. I slammed my staff down on the floor, and Billy flinched. He tried to cover it, but I had seen the motion. Billy flinched like he was genuinely afraid that I was going to hurt him. What the hell? Billy, I said quietly, there is some bad business going on. I don't have time for this. I don't know what Bach told you, but he's had a bad couple of days. He's rattled. I'm not going to hold anything against him. All right, he said quietly. I want you to go home, I told him, and I want you to start sending out word around to the in crowd. Everyone wants to be behind a threshold tonight. He frowned and took off his glasses, scrubbing at them with the corner of his shirt. Why? Because the White Council is sending a war party to town. You don't want anyone you know to get caught in the backwash. Billy swallowed. This is big, then? And I have to get moving. I don't have time for distractions. I stepped forward and put my hand on his shoulder. Hey, it's me, Harry. I'm as sane as I ever am, and I need you to trust me for a little while. Tell people to keep their heads down, okay? He took a deep breath and then nodded sharply. I'll do it, man. Good. I don't know why you're so worried about me, but we'll sit down and talk after the dust settles. Figure out what's up. Make sure I haven't stripped a gear when I wasn't looking, I promise you. Right, he said, nodding. Thank you. I'm sorry if this is a... Oh, hell, man. Enough with sharing the emotions, I said. We're going to turn into women as we stand here. Get a move on. He chucked my arm with a mostly closed fist and left. I waited for him to go. I didn't feel like riding down in the elevator with him, wondering if he was afraid of me suddenly turning on him with an axe or a butcher knife or something. I leaned on my staff and thought about it for a second. Billy was really worried about me. Worried enough that he was afraid that I might do something to him. What the hell had I done to set that off? And an even better question, which I had to ask myself, followed on the heels of that first one. What if he was right? I poked at my skull with a finger. It didn't feel soft or anything. I didn't feel insane. But if you'd really lost it, would you have enough left upstairs to know? Crazy people never thought they were crazy. I've always talked to things, I said, and to myself. Good point, myself agreed with me, unless that means you've been nuts all along. I don't need wise-ass remarks, I told myself severely. There's work to do, so shut up. All I could think was that it had been George's idea. She was always buried to the ears in her psych textbooks. Maybe she had fallen victim to some kind of inverted psychological hypochondria or something. Thunder rumbled outside, and the rain started coming down harder. I didn't need any doubts distracting me right now. I shrugged off the whole conversation with Billy, tabling it for later. I loaded my gun, since not loading it would have been almost as good as not having it, then slipped it back into my pocket, locked up my office behind me, and headed for the car. I had to get to Sheila and see if her remarkable memory could call up the poems and stanzas from that stupid book. And then I had to figure out how to call up a wild and deadly lord of the darker realms of fairy and sidetrack him so that the heirs of Kemler couldn't use him to promote themselves to demigod status. And along the way, I had to find the word of Kemler and get it to Mavra somehow without the White Council learning what I was up to. Easy as breathing. As I rode down in the elevator, I had to admit that Billy might have a point.
Chapter 28. The Cabrini Green tenement Sheila lived in had seen better days, but it had seen worse, too. The city had dumped a lot of money into urban renewal projects there, and it was an ongoing process. Sheila's building was still undergoing renovation, and the lobby and many of the floors were only half-finished. No workmen were in the building when I went into the lobby, but there were dozens of tarps, stacks of drywall and raw lumber, heavy tool lockers that had been bolted to the floor, and other evidence of the contractors who would doubtless have been working had the city's lights not been out. I walked over to the elevators into the security panel there and found the button of Sheila's apartment on the 9th floor. I pressed it and held it down for a minute before I realized that, duh, the power was out and I wasn't going to be able to ring her apartment. I grimaced and looked around for the stairs. 9 flights up on my leg wasn't going to feel nice, but it wasn't as though I had an infinite number of options. The door to the stairs was locked, but it was a standard fire door with a push bar on the other side. I lifted my staff, looked around the lobby to make sure no one had wandered in to see me, and then gestured with the staff and murmured, "Forzare." I sent a bare whisper of my power through the door and then drew it back toward me with a sharp gesture. I caught the push bar on the other side with it, and the door trembled and then swung open by an inch or two. I thrust the end of my staff into it to hold it open, then grabbed it and heaved. I stared at the stairs for a second, but they didn't get any shorter or turn into an escalator or anything, so I sighed and started painfully hauling myself up them, one step at a time. 9 floors and 162 steps later, I paused to catch my breath, and then opened the door to the 9th floor hallway in the same manner I had the one in the lobby. The 9th floor hallway was still under construction, and several of the apartments in it were missing doors and even walls. I limped along until I found Sheila's apartment and then knocked on the door. I felt a tingling tension over the door as I touched it, a magical ward of some kind. It was nowhere near as strong as the ones on my apartment had been, but it was stable. That was fairly impressive. Sheila might not have a ton of inborn talent, but she evidently had enough discipline to offset the lack. I held my hand out lightly, just over the surface of the door, sending my senses running over the ward, getting more of a feel for its strength. It couldn't have stopped me if I used my power to force my way in, but it felt strong enough to give me a solid kick in the teeth if I tried it physically. It would certainly scare the hell out of a would-be burglar. Not bad. After a minute, I heard footsteps, and the door opened a little. I could see a security chain and a slender stripe of her face that included one of Sheila's dark, sparkling eyes. She let out a surprised little sound and then said, "Harry, just a minute." I waited while she shut the door and took off the security chain. Then she opened the door again, smiling at me. She had an infectious smile, and I found myself answering it with one of my own. She was dressed in a scarlet sequined bodice that made her chest into something very difficult not to stare at, nearly translucent baggy leggings, leather sandals that wrapped around her calves, and 6.5 million pounds of bangles on her arms and ankles. Her hair had been caught up in a high ponytail, fixed into place to rise over some kind of mesh headdress, and her smooth, bare shoulders looked lovely and strong. "Hi," she said. "Hi," I said back. "Is your roommate Sheila in, Jeannie?" She laughed. "You caught me in the nick of time. I was just about to leave to get together with some people I know." "Costume party?" I asked. "No, I dress like this all the time." Her eyes sparkled. "It is Halloween." "Even with the lights out?" She bobbed her brows, her smile wicked for a second. "Who knows? That might make it more fun." I had been right about the curves that had been hidden under her loose clothing back at Box. They were awfully pleasant ones. It was an effort of will to stay focused on her face, especially when she laughed. Her laugh made all sorts of interesting little quivers run over her. "Do you have a minute?" I asked. "Maybe even two," she said. "What did you have in mind?" "I need your help with something," I said. I looked up and down the hallway. As far as I knew, I hadn't been followed, and I'd been watching my back, but that didn't mean that no one was there.
I was pretty good at noticing such things, but there were plenty of people, and non-people, who were better than me. If you don't mind, can we talk about it inside? Her expression became a little wary, and she looked up and down the hall herself. Are you in trouble? Is this about the people at the store? Pretty much, I said. May I come in? Of course, she said, and stepped back inside, holding the door open for me. I limped in. Oh, my God, she said, staring at me as I came in. What happened? A ghoul threw a knife into my leg, I told her. She blinked at me. You mean a real ghoul? An actual ghoul? Yeah. Her face twisted up with dismay. Oh, wow. I've heard stories, but I never thought. You know, it's hard to believe they're really out there. Does that make me an idiot? No, I said. It makes you lucky. If I never see another ghoul, it'll be too soon. Her apartment was pretty typical of the kind. Small, worn, run down, but clean. She had mostly second-hand furniture, an ancient old fridge, mismatched bookshelves that overflowed with paperbacks and textbooks, and a tiny aged television that looked as if it didn't get much use. Sit down, she said, picking up a couple of blankets and a throw pillow from the couch, clearing off a space for me. I tottered over to the couch and sat, which felt entirely too good. I grunted and got my leg elevated onto the coffee table, and it felt even better. Thanks, I said. She shook her head, staring at me. You look frightful. Been a tough couple of days. She studied me with serious eyes. I suppose it must have been. What are you doing here? The book, I said. The one on the Earl King that I got from Bach. I remember, she said. Exactly. What? That's why I'm here, I said. You remember, but I don't. And the bad guy stole my copy. I need you to remember it for me. She frowned. The whole thing? I don't think so, I said. There were several poems and stanzas in there. I think what I need is in one of them. What do you need? She said. I stared at her for a second, then I said, It might be better if you don't know. She lifted her chin and regarded me for a moment, as if I'd just said something bad about her mother. Excuse me? This is some bad business, I said. It might be safer for you if I don't tell you much about it. Well, she said, that's quite patronizing of you, Harry. Thank you. I held up a hand. It isn't like that. Yes, she said, it is. You want me to give you information, but you won't tell me why or what you're going to do with it. It's for your own protection, I said. Perhaps, she replied. But if I give you this information, I'm going to bear some responsibility for what you do with it. We don't know each other very well. What if you took the information I gave you and used it to hurt someone? I won't. And maybe that's true, she said. But maybe it isn't. Don't you see? I have an obligation in this matter, she said, to use my talent responsibly. That means not using it blindly or recklessly. Can you understand that? Actually, I said, I can. She pursed her lips and then nodded. Then if you want me to help you, tell me why you need it. You could be put at risk if you become involved in this, I said. It could be very dangerous. I left a clear silence between the last two words for emphasis. I understand, she said. I accept that, so tell me. I stared at her for a second and then sighed, a little frustrated. She had a point, after all. But damn it, I didn't want to see anyone else get hurt because of Kemmler's disciples, particularly not anyone with such lovely breasts. I jerked my eyes away from them and said, The people you've seen around the store are going to use the book to call up the Earl King. She frowned. But he's an extremely powerful fairy, yes? Can they do that? Do you mean, is it possible? I asked. Sure. I whistled up Queen Mab a few hours ago myself, which was technically the truth. Oh, she said, her tone mild. Why? Because I needed information, I said. No, not that. Why are these people calling up the Earl King? They're going to use his presence on Halloween night to call up an extra-large helping of ancient spirits. Then they're going to bind and devour those spirits in order to give themselves a Valhalla-sized portion of supernatural power. She stared at me, her mouth opening a little.
It's a rite of ascension, she whispered. A real one?
Yeah, I said.
But that's insane.
So are these people, I said. What you tell me could stop it from happening. It could save a lot of lives, not least of which is my own. She folded her arms over her stomach as if chilled. Her face looked pale and worried. I need the poems because I'm going to summon the Earl King before they can do it and make sure that I sidetrack him long enough to ruin their plans.
Isn't that dangerous? She asked.
Not as dangerous as doing nothing, I said. So now you know why. Will you help me? She fretted her lower lip as though mulling it over, but her eyes were sparkling.
Say please.
Please, I said. Her smile widened.
Pretty, please?
Don't push me, I half growled, but I doubt it came out very intimidating. She smiled at me.
It might take me a few minutes. I haven't looked at that book in some time. I'll have to prepare, meditate.
Is it that complicated? I asked. She sighed, the smile fading.
There's so much of it. Sometimes my head feels like a library. I don't have a problem remembering. It's finding where I've put it that's a challenge. And not all of it is very pleasant to remember.
I know what that's like, I said. I've seen some things I would rather weren't in my head. She nodded and paced over to settle down on the couch next to me. She drew her feet up underneath her and wriggled a bit to get comfortable. The wriggling part was intriguing. I tried not to be too obviously interested and fumbled my notebook and trusty pencil from my duster's pocket.
All right, she said and closed her eyes. Give me a moment. I'll speak it to you.
Okay, I said.
And don't stare at me.
I moved my eyes.
I wasn't.
She snorted delicately.
Haven't you ever seen breasts before?
I wasn't staring, I protested.
Of course.
She opened one eye and gave me a sly, oblique glance. Then she closed her eyes with a little smile and inhaled deeply.
That's cheating, I said.
She smiled again, and then her expression changed, her features growing remote. Her shoulders eased into relaxation, and then her eyes opened, dark, distant, and unfocused. She stared into the far distance for several moments, her breathing slowing, and her eyes started moving as if she were reading a book.
Here it is, she said, her voice slow, quiet, and dreamy. Peabody. He was the one to compile the various essays.
I just need the poems, I said. No need for the cover plate.
Hush, she said. This isn't as easy as it looks.
Her fingers and hands twitched now and then, while her eyes swept over the unseen book. I realized after a moment that she was turning the pages of the book in her memory.
All right, she said a minute later. Ready?
I poised my pencil over my notepad.
Ready.
She started quoting poetry to me, and I started writing it down. It wasn't in the first poem or the second, but in the third one, I recognized the rhythms and patterns of a phrase of summoning. Each line innocent on its own, but each building on the ones preceding it. With the proper focus, intent, and strength of will, the simple poem could reach out beyond the borders of the mortal world and draw the notice of the deadly fairy hunter known as the Earl King, the Lord of Goblins.
That's the one, I said quietly.
I need you to be completely sure of your accuracy of recollection. Sheila nodded, her eyes far away. Her hand made a reverse of the page-turning motion she used, and she spoke the poem to me again, more slowly. I double-checked that I'd written it all down correctly. It doesn't do to mangle a summoning. If you get the words wrong, it can have all kinds of bad effects. Best-case scenario, the summoning doesn't work, and you pour all the effort into it for nothing. One step worse, a bungled summoning could call up the wrong being, maybe one that would be happy to rip off your face with its tentacle-laden, extendable maw. Finally, at the extreme end of negative consequences, the failed summons might call up the being you wanted, in this case the Earl King, only it would be insulted that you hadn't bothered to get it right. Uber-powerful beings of the spirit world had the kind of power and tempers that horror movies are made of, and it was a bad idea to get one of them mad at you. If you called up a being incorrectly, there was very little you could do to protect yourself from them. That was the job hazard of summoning. If I chanted the Earl King to Chicago, I had to be damn sure I did it correctly, or it would be worth as much as my life. Once more, I told Sheila quietly when she was finished. I had to be sure. She nodded and began again. I checked my written version. They all came out the same for the third time in a row, so I was as sure as I reasonably could be that it was accurate. I stared at the notepad for a moment, trying to absorb the summoning, to remember its rhythm, the rolling sound of consonant and verb that were only incidentally related to language. This wasn't a poem. It was simply a frequency, a signal of sound and timing, and I committed it with methodical precision to memory, the same way I stored the precise inflections required to call upon a spirit being using its true name. In a sense, the poem was a name for the Earl King. He would respond to it in the same way. When I looked up again a few moments later, I felt the gentle pressure of Sheila's gaze. She was watching me, her eyes worried. "You're either incredibly stupid, or one of the most courageous men I've ever seen." "Go with stupid," I said lightly. "In my experience, you can't go wrong assuming stupid."
"If you use the summoning," she said quietly, not smiling at my tone, "and something bad happens to you, I will be to blame."
I shook my head. "No," I said. "I know what I'm doing. It will be my own damn fault."
"I'm not sure that your acceptance can absolve me of responsibility," she said, frowning. "Is there anything else I can do to help you?"
"There's no need to offer," I said.
"Yes," she said earnestly, "there is. I need to know that I've done whatever I can. That if something happens to you, it won't be because of something I didn't do."
I studied her face for a moment and found myself smiling. "You take this whole responsibility thing very seriously," I said.
"Is there some reason I shouldn't?" she asked.
"Not at all," I said. "It's just unusual from someone... Well, don't take this the wrong way, but it's unusual from someone so far down the ladder when it comes to raw power." She smiled a little.
"It doesn't take much power to hurt someone," she said. "It's far easier than healing the damage. It's always like that, for everything, not just magic."
"Yeah, but not many people seem to get that." I reached over and put my right hand on hers. She had very soft, very warm hands. "Thank you for helping me. If there's anything I can ever do to pay you back..." She smiled at me and said,
"There is one thing."
"Oh?" I asked. She nodded.
"A friend told me once that you can tell a lot about a person from how they do things the first time."
I blinked a couple of times and then said, like what?"
"Like this," she said, and came to me. She moved beautifully, fluid and graceful and elegantly feminine. She was all warm curves and soft flesh, scented of wildflowers, as she slid one leg over mine, straddling my thighs. Her gentle hands lightly framed my face as she leaned down to kiss me, her eyes rolling back and closing in anticipation as her mouth met mine. The kiss began slowly, quietly, sensuous but not impassioned, patience without hesitance. Her lips were a warm and gentle contact on mine, and there was a sense of exploration to her mouth as she felt her way around the kiss. Maybe I was just too tired or too injured or too worried about my prospects for immediate survival, but it felt good. It felt really good. Sheila's mouth wasn't inflamed with need. She demanded nothing with the kiss. All she wanted was to taste my mouth, to feel my skin under her hands. And then, without warning, a desperate yearning for more of that simple contact, that human warmth, roared through me in a flash fire of need.
Nearly everyone underestimates how powerful the touch of another person's hand can be. The need to be touched is something so primal, so fundamentally a part of our existence as human beings, that its true impact upon us can be difficult to put into words. That power doesn't necessarily have anything to do with sex, either. From the time we are infants, we learn to associate the touch of a human hand with safety, with comfort, with love. I hadn't been touched much for, well, a long damn time. Thomas may have been my brother, but he avoided physical contact, even casual and incidental contact, like the plague. I hadn't exactly been overwhelmed with romantic interests, either. The closest thing to it I'd had of late had been the advances of a neophyte succubus, and that contact had been anything but loving. When sex becomes part of the equation, the impact of another's touch can be even more urgent and profound, so much so that good sense, even basic logical deduction, can go right out the window, washed away in a flood of needs that simply must be met. I hadn't been touched in a long time. I hadn't been kissed in even longer. Given how likely it was that I was going to die before my next sunrise, Sheila's presence, her warmth, the simple fact that she wanted to be touching me, crowded out every worry and fear, and I was glad to see them go. Sheila's kiss freed me from pain and from fear, even if only for a moment, and I wanted to hold on to that moment for as long as I possibly could. I tightened my grip on the kiss, and my good arm rose, sliding deliberately around the small of her back, pulling her toward me. Sheila let out a hiss of sudden excitement, but her kiss grew no deeper, no swifter. Her mouth stayed in its gentle rhythm, and I leaned harder into it. Her breath quickened still more, but her kiss deepened only slowly, maddeningly patient, torturously gentle. Her hips shifted in slow tension against mine, and I could feel the heat of her against me. What I wanted to do was to reach up and haul down the sequined top. I wanted my mouth to explore every sinuous curve of her. I wanted to drive her mad with need, to fill my senses with her warmth, her cries, her scent. I wanted to forget everything arrayed against me, even if it was just for a little while, and bear her an inch at a time. The emptiness that her warmth had begun to fill howled at me to let go. But what I did was open my mouth and brush my tongue over her lips, gently and slowly, and only once. She shivered at that touch, and her teeth tugged delicately at my lower lip. I drew the kiss to a slow, quiet close and bowed my head so that my forehead rested against hers. Both of us remained like that for a minute, breathing a little fast.
"Did you want to stop?" she whispered.
"No," I answered. "But I needed to."
"Why?"
"Because you don't know me," I said. "Did you want me to stop?"
"No," she said. "But I needed you to. You don't know me either."
"Then why kiss me?" I asked. I heard a touch of something like embarrassment in her voice.
"It's been a long time for me, since I've kissed anyone. I didn't realize how much I'd missed it."
"Same here." Her fingers stirred lightly, touching the sides of my face.
"You seem so alone. I just wanted to know what it was like, just the kiss, before anything else gets involved."
"That's reason enough," I agreed. "What did you think of it?" She made a low sound in her throat.
"I think I want more."
I said, agreeing. "That works for me." She let out a quiet, wicked little laugh.
"Good."
She shivered again and then drew away from me, dark eyes bright, still breathing fast enough to make her chest absolutely mesmerizing. She stood up, smiling.
"Is there anything else I can do to help you?"
"Grab my staff for me?" She arched a brow. I felt my cheeks flush. The literal staff.
"Oh,"
she said, and passed it to me. She watched me with quiet concern as I heaved myself to my feet, but she made no move to help me, for which my ego was entirely grateful. I hobbled over to her door, and she walked beside me. I turned to her and touched her cheek with my right hand. She leaned her face against my palm, just a little, and smiled up at me. "Thank you," I told her. "You're a lifesaver, probably literally." She looked down and nodded.
"All right. Be careful."
"I'll try," I told her.
"Try hard," she said. "I'd like to see you again soon."
"Okay, I'll survive, but only because you asked." She laughed, and I smiled, and then I left her in her apartment and started back down the stairs to the street. Going down was a lot harder than going up had been. I made it to the third floor before I had to stop for a breather, and I sat down to rest my aching leg for a moment. So I was panting and sitting flat on my ass when the air in front of me wavered, and a dark, hooded figure stepped forward from out of nowhere, one hand extended, some sort of fine mesh that covered her outstretched palm, flickering with ugly purple light.
"Be very still, Dresden,"
Kumori said, her voice soft.
"If you try to move, I'll kill you."
Chapter 29. Kumori stood about 4 feet from me, easily within reach of my staff if I wanted to strike at her, but since I was sitting down and had only one strong hand to swing the staff, I wouldn't be able to hit hard enough to disable her, even if I somehow managed to hit her before she unleashed the power she was holding in her hand. And besides, she was a girl. Unless she proved herself to be some kind of monstrous thing that just looked like a girl, I wasn't going to hit her. On some rational level, I knew my attitude was dangerously illogical, but that didn't change anything. I don't hit girls. I had the feeling she was quick enough to beat me as she stood over me with the magical equivalent of a cocked and readied gun sparkling through the metal mesh over her right palm. I could feel the air vibrating with a low, steady note of power, and her stance was both confident and wary. One thing I was pretty sure of, she was here to talk. If she'd wanted to kill me, she could have done it already. So I stayed sitting, set my staff aside very slowly, and mildly raised both hands. "Take it easy there, cowgirl," I said. "You got me dead to rights." I couldn't see her face within the depths of the hood, but I heard a dry note of amusement in her voice.
"Take off the bracelet, please, and the ring on your right hand."
I arched a brow. The ring was spent, and probably didn't have enough juice left in it to push her back a step, but I'd never run into anyone who had noticed it before. Whoever she was, Kumori knew how wizards operated, and it made me even more sure that she was hiding her face because she was someone I might recognize, someone on the White Council. I slipped the bracelet off my left hand and lowered it slowly to the stair beside me, but getting that ring off was going to be problematic. "I can't get the ring off," I said.
"Why not?"
Kumori asked. "Fingers on my left hand don't work anymore," I said.
"What happened?"
I blinked at her for a second. The question had been polite. In fact, if I didn't know any better, I'd have taken her tone for actual interest.
"What happened to your left hand?"
she asked, her tone patient. I answered her as politely as I could while staring at her, trying to figure her out. "I was fighting vampires. There was a fire. Burned my hand so bad the doctors wanted to take it off. There's no way I can get the ring off unless you want to come over here and take it yourself." She was still for a moment. Then she said,
"It might be easier if you would agree to a truce for the duration of this conversation. Are you willing to give your word on it?"
She wanted a truce, which meant that she had indeed come to talk rather than to execute me. There sure as hell wouldn't be any harm in agreeing to a truce, and it might prevent hostilities that could be triggered by raw nerves. "In exchange for yours," I said, "this conversation and half an hour after its conclusion."
"Done,"
Kumori said.
"You have my word."
"And you have mine," I said. She lowered her hand at once, taking the odd mesh over it and its sparkling energies into the deep sleeves of her robe. I didn't take my eyes off her as I reclaimed my shield bracelet and fixed it back onto my wrist.